This is Audible.
This publication contains the opinions and ideas of its author. It is intended to provide helpful and informative material on the subjects addressed in the publication. It is sold with the understanding that the author and publisher are not engaged in rendering medical, health, or any other kind of personal professional services in the book. The reader should consult his or her medical, health, or other competent professional before adopting any of the suggestions in this book or drawing inferences from it. The author and publisher specifically disclaim all responsibility for any liability, loss or risk, personal or otherwise, which is incurred as a consequence directly or indirectly of the use and application of any of the contents of this book.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The TB12 Method, How to Achieve a Lifetime of Sustained Peak Performance by Tom Brady. Read by Jonathan Todd Ross and Tom Brady.
I dedicate this book to all the people who have loved me, supported me, and helped me achieve my dreams. My incredible family, my loving wife and beautiful children, my lifelong friends, my Sarah High School, University of Michigan, and New England Patriots teammates, my encouraging coaches, and the loyal mentors who have played a part in who I am and what I believe in. Thank you. I love you all. Introduction. Just before the start of the Patriots 2016 championship season, I went to a field near my house to throw the football with one of my dearest friends, my body coach, and the co-founder of the TB12 Method, Alex Guerrero, and a former teammate. It was a brisk, early fall afternoon, perfect New England football weather. As I was running through my typical football training regimen, I knew one thing for sure. I'd never thrown the ball as well as I did that day, not when the Patriots won the Super Bowl in 2001, or in 2004, 2005, or 2014. Not ever, in fact, in my life. It was one of those days. I was in the zone. I was throwing the ball better than I ever had, and I remember being really excited about the opportunity to play and to show all the things I had been working on in the offseason. I also remember thinking, my ability to sustain my peak performance over the past 10 years is almost unbelievable to me. But I suppose that's what peak performance really means, continuing to get better year after year. Or at least that's what it means to me. In my belief, it would not be possible without an ongoing commitment to the very different holistic wellness and training program that Alex and I began developing over a decade ago. We call it the TB12 Method. At its core, the TB12 Method focuses on developing and maintaining something that many people had probably never heard of, muscle pliability. Over the past few years, we have designed the principles of the TB12 Method, principles that have created far more sustained peak performance than anything I've ever read, studied, experienced, or trained against, and that have also given me the confidence and the capability to reach for higher and higher levels of achievement as each year passes. Every year we seek to improve, and I would love for you to do the same. Nearly 18 seasons of playing professional football have shown me that sustained peak performance isn't about luck. It's about hard work, dedication, discipline, and the support of my great team. You can't do it alone. I am beyond blessed. I turned 40 years old this past August, and not only do I feel as healthy as I ever have, but more to the point, I'm proud to still be playing at the highest level and standard for my game. My ability to sustain my peak performance over the last 10 years came from rethinking how to train, and specifically, how to train with pliability. I now realize that this is something that can help not only elite athletes, but anyone and everyone who's willing to commit to living a life of wellness and vitality. Casual athletes, weekend warriors, yoga practitioners, marathon runners, anyone. In this book, I'll be sharing the principles that have allowed me to sustain peak performance and showing you how to apply them to your own daily life. I also believe the TB12 method can inspire a movement that radically reforms the way we train and helps us live a more natural, holistic, healthy lifestyle while lowering our risk of injury, increasing our vitality, and taking our performance to the next level. As such, I'm writing this book in the hope that my experiences and discoveries can resonate with everyone and allow them to achieve beyond what they can even envision for themselves. As far as pliability is concerned, an ounce of prevention really is worth a pound of cure. What is pliability? I'll go into it in more detail later in this book, but for now, and briefly, Alex and I define pliability training as targeted, deep force muscle work that lengthens and softens muscles. At the same time, those muscles are rhythmically contracted and relaxed. This happens in sessions that take place both before and after any sport or activity. In my case, football. Regular pliability training, coupled with the right holistic routine to maintain that pliability, conditions our brains and bodies, and therefore our muscles, to maintain the same lengthened, softened prime state as they carry out whatever activity we're asking them to do, from carrying a baby to lifting luggage, to climbing stairs, to getting out of a chair, to playing pro sports. But pliability is also bigger than that. To me, and within the TB12 method, pliability is the missing leg of the traditional strength and conditioning model of aerobic activity and lifting weights. Of course, it goes without saying that we all need strength and conditioning, enough strength to do the job we need to do, including the acts of daily living, and enough endurance to do it over a desired time frame. But by incorporating pliability training into your workout regimen, you'll be able to sustain your own peak performance in ways that minimize the risk of injury. If an injury happens, pliability training will put you on a faster road to recovery. We'll discuss specific methods of practicing pliability in a later chapter. So why this book, and why now? Well, most people don't realize it, but the typical training and lifestyle regimens come up short. For so many athletes, it looks like this. Work out, compete hard, get injured, visit the doctor, do physical therapy, possible surgery, back to rehab, compete hard again, get injured again, back to the doctor, more rehab, repeat, repeat, repeat. That's the vicious cycle of sports training, which takes place far too often, is talked about all too little, and has been around since before I was in high school. But it doesn't have to be that way. We all need to become active participants in our own health. With this book, I want to establish a new model of training for sustaining peak performance and optimal living over the long term. The TB12 method is both a regimen and a way of life that has allowed me to play football at a high level over the course of my career, and also to live a vital, energetic life off the field. Over the years, like many athletes, I've read a lot of books about sports, health, wellness, and longevity. Most offer conflicting information, and to my mind, a lot of them come up short. Put simply, they're confusing. Even I get confused. That's why I want to write a new athlete's Bible for anyone committed to a lifetime of peak performance, whether you're a professional, an amateur, or a man or a woman of any age who wants to stay healthy and vital. My hope is that the TB12 method will revolutionize the age-old sports and conditioning model that statistics tell us over and over again is incomplete. With this book, I'm on a mission to inspire coaches, parents, trainers, athletes, and anyone who wants to lead a healthier lifestyle to consider how pliability training and the commitment to a holistic and disciplined lifestyle will lead to a more enjoyable life that allows them to achieve any goal they set for themselves. Nothing would give me more joy than to pass on what I've learned during my life and career, whether it's the importance of pliability training, the exercises you should do to reduce the chance of injury, the best ways to work out, what proper hydration means, what foods you should eat, what supplements you should take, how to recover and rest, or what kinds of brain exercises can ramp up your performance. There's a famous quote, "Youth is wasted on the young." It's true, too. We grow up believing that our physical prime is in our mid to late 20s, and our mental peak is somewhere between the ages of 30 and 50. One of the goals of the TB12 method is to combine our physical peak with our mental peak while extending both of them for as long as possible. Ultimately, our stated purpose at TB12 is sustained peak performance, which is something I want as many people as possible to experience in their own lives. We're all born with natural pliability, and we have more pliability than strength, at least when we're young, meaning that our muscles are naturally longer and softer than they are dense. Our natural pliability allows us to play hard and recover quickly. Usually, a good night's rest is all it takes when we're young. Many of us begin focusing on strength and conditioning when we're in our teens in order to play sports. We stay on this path for the rest of our lives, not understanding that as time goes on and we continue to work on strength and conditioning alone, our bodies become tighter, stiffer, and unbalanced, both through strength training and the acts of daily living, which leads to compensation, which leads to overload, therefore making us more and more susceptible to injury. What actually happens when an injury occurs? An injury takes place when one of our muscles, ligaments, tendons, or bones is unable to absorb or disperse the amount of force placed on it. Put simply, when any of these body parts comes up against more force or stress than it can handle, an injury happens. Are injuries avoidable? Certainly not all of them, but many of them are. I recently read a comment given by a professional soccer coach after a game in which one of his players got injured. Injuries happen, he said. They're part of a player's life, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. I don't completely agree. What if, instead of accepting injury as inevitable and a part of what it means to play sports, trainers and coaches began incorporating pliability training into the traditional strength and conditioning system, educating bodies to absorb and disperse the forces placed upon them? With pliability acting as a form of the body's defense system against external forces, I believe many of those inevitable injuries could be avoided. The principles of the TB12 method are ones I've always wanted to share with other athletes who, like me, may not be natural athletes. Many people forget I was a six-round draft pick, but who have the same drive, desire, and work ethic that I do, and who are tired of putting all their energy into methods that are likely to disable them in the end. I've seen this firsthand over the past 25 years, watching one athlete after another get hurt and rehab, rehab, rehab. Exercise, working out, and engaging in physical activity are all parts of a joyful life, and I'm positive that if athletes follow the TB12 method, they will perform significantly better over a much longer period of time. The bottom line is that the conditioning and endurance training that clients practice at TB12 help create the energy and vitality they need to perform the acts of daily living in an optimal way. I also want to emphasize that the TB12 method isn't just for athletes who work in elite environments like the NFL, the NHL, the NBA, and MLB, and do stress and break down their bodies the most. To my mind, everyone can benefit from greater pliability and a balanced body that allows more oxygen-rich blood circulation and increased vitality. The amount of pliability that will benefit you the most depends on the intensity of your activity and the type of sport or activity you engage in. Swimming, for example, is different from playing baseball, which is different from cycling. Obviously, playing football as I do, my body needs to absorb a lot of force every week. As I go into my 18th season, I now do pliability training 4 days a week, and among strength, conditioning, and pliability, I spend roughly one half of my time on pliability training. Many athletes spend no time on pliability. In fact, many athletes don't know what pliability is, and others might spend only a few minutes. A person who works behind a desk and isn't stressing his or her body every day needs a different level of pliability, say once a week. Whereas a high school athlete who works out for 2 hours a few times a week needs higher levels. A simple way to think about it is that strength training, playing sports, and working out create denser muscles. And the denser the muscles are, the more pliability they need. It can be hard for younger athletes to wrap their heads around the concept of pliability because they have natural pliability. They recover quickly and don't want to waste their time preventing an injury that hasn't happened yet. Many of them aren't thinking ahead to pain, soreness, or worse in the future. As I said, younger bodies are naturally pliable, which is why in high school and college, young athletes need more strength than they do pliability. As athletes hit their 20s, their strength increases as their pliability decreases. As their pliability goes down, their injuries go up. And as their injuries go up, their careers get cut short. Ability allows athletes to achieve. Durability allows them to continue achieving. And pliability makes both possible. This is why coaches and parents need to take the lead by incorporating pliability training as early as possible in the lives of younger athletes. If I'd begun pliability training when I was 15 or 16 years old, I wouldn't have had to endure so many years of unnecessary pain as so many athletes do. If you want proof that pliability and the TB12 method works, I'm it. I was the kid, as you'll learn in the chapters ahead, who was the 6th-round NFL draft pick, 199th overall, the athlete who was told he never had the right body for football. No one believed I'd play even 1 year in college or 1 year in the pros. But I just finished my 17th season. The Patriots won the Super Bowl, and not a lot of players have ever started at quarterback in the NFL at the age of 40. If you want a great case study for how the TB12 method can transform someone, including the thousands of men and women whose lives have been changed at the TB12 Sports Therapy Center in Foxborough, Massachusetts, it's standing right in front of you. I'm excited for you to start your own journey. Chapter 1, What I Used to Believe. I've loved sports and been extremely competitive at them my whole life. I may have picked up my first football at age 5, but the path that got me to where I am today was never really straight or easy. I was born and grew up in San Mateo, California, in the Bay Area, the youngest of 4 children and the only boy. Everyone always called me Tommy. We were a hard-working, sports-centric family with parents who put their kids before anything else. When I was young, my dad was self-employed and on the road a lot, building up his insurance business. He was out the door by 7 in the morning and gone till 6 at night. My mom was in charge of the house, washing our clothes, cooking our meals, always keeping the domestic side of the family going. My dad was tired when he got home from work, but he never let that get in the way of our time together. He'd still be in his dress shirt when he drove me to the baseball field or the driving range, where the two of us would hit or field ground balls or practice throwing as the day grew dark. I loved those times with my dad, and on the drives back home, I remember that good feeling of, I'm hitting the baseball better, or I think I may be fielding better. I still feel that way today. For example, with my throwing mechanics, I'm still always improving and learning. My parents were just as involved in my sister's lives in sports. My dad would coach their team sometimes, with my mom serving as the team mom, getting pizza and soda for all the players. My parents also had 4 season tickets to the San Francisco 49ers games at Candlestick Park, 10 rows from the top of the stadium on the southwest side, basically in the south end zone. On Sundays, we all went to church in the morning, then made the 45-minute drive to Candlestick and the 49ers game. And when it was over, back at home, my mom would start getting dinner ready while the rest of us gathered around to watch the game highlights on TV. Those 4 season tickets usually went to my dad and mom, one of my sisters, and me, since going to a game was always the high point of my weekend. I can't say I have that vivid of a memory of it, but on January 10th, 1982, when I was 4 years old, I was at Candlestick Park during one of the greatest games in football history. On the final drive of the NFC Championship game, the 49ers were down by 6 points with 51 seconds left to play when Joe Montana, the 49ers quarterback, got around a 3-man rush and threw the pass that became the catch. A perfect ball that his receiver Dwight Clark leaped up to grab just inside the end zone. Everyone in the stadium jumped up. People were crying, including me. Though, to be honest, I've been crying during the whole first half too, since I wanted a foam finger with the 49ers R number 1 printed on it. I think my dad finally bought me one at halftime just to shut me up. Clark's touchdown tied the score, and when the kicker, Ray Wershing, made the extra point, the game ended with the 49ers winning 28-27. The catch put an end to the Dallas Cowboys' 1970s domination of the NFL and started a new era for the 49ers, who went on to win the Super Bowl that year against the Cincinnati Bengals. To be 4 years old and watching that game with a foam finger was, I have to say, pretty incredible. It's no surprise that, for a kid growing up in the Bay Area and loving football and sports in general as much as I did, Joe Montana was one of my earliest idols. That wasn't so unusual. Everyone loved Joe Montana. He was Joe Cool, after all. He had a knack for coming through in the clutch, the same way Michael Jordan or Wayne Gretzky always managed to make the winning play at the right time. By the age of 10, I remember playing outside on the street with my friend David Aguirre, drawing up simple football plays on a sheet of paper. Okay, you run to the fire hydrant. Now you break out. Then you go deep. We even made up our own plays, which we memorized. My favorite was called the secret weapon. You run up, you break out, and then you run back to the post. By the time I entered my freshman year at Junipero Serra High School in San Mateo, my natural love for football had kicked in. In the summer after that, I started attending football camp at the College of San Mateo, where I was a staple for the next 4 years. My size, by my senior year in high school I was 6'4", 210 pounds, probably played a part in my ability to play as many different sports as I did, not just football, but also basketball and baseball. Despite my size, though, the thing I remember most about those days is how so many of the teammates I played alongside were just playing better than I was, faster, stronger, with superior natural physical abilities. I always felt I was being left behind. However, whatever I lacked in skills, I tried to make up for with a work ethic I'm pretty sure I picked up from my family and environment. Early on, my family instilled in me a drive to always learn to do better, and discipline came pretty naturally to me, too. When I was in fifth grade, my oldest sister, Maureen, who was already a very good athlete, began getting seriously involved in high school sports. My dad would get up early to train alongside her at the local athletic club, and I tagged along with them every morning at 6 a.m. The club trainer was a guy named Glenn. One of the great things about Glenn was that he didn't just hold Maureen accountable, he held me accountable too. 30 years later, I still remember Glenn saying, I want you to do 100 jumping jacks, 25 push-ups, and 25 sit-ups every morning. On the days you don't come to the gym, I want you to do them at home. And when you're all done with your workout, leave me a message on my answering machine. For every message I left him, Glenn promised to pay me $1. For every day I didn't leave Glenn a message, I would owe him $5. For whatever it's worth, I ended up owing Glenn money. Discipline needs to be reinforced daily as well. This same work ethic and discipline instilled in me by Glenn, and to a bigger extent by my family, inspired me from the start to seek out every last bit of extra help I could get from coaches, trainers, and basically anyone who pushed me to push myself to the next level. Football camp, for example, was where I met the great Tom Martinez, coach of the football program at the College of San Mateo, as well as the college's women's softball and basketball teams. From that point on, even after joining the New England Patriots, I always tracked Tom down for advice whenever something didn't feel right or if I had any questions about throwing mechanics. I can't say how many pro quarterbacks my age, who played as long as I have, would do this, but during every NFL offseason, up until his death in 2012, I called on Tom for his counsel. He's a mentor I think about often. I would be remiss if I didn't mention another throwing mentor, Tom House, who has also taught me a tremendous amount over the past 5 years. I sought out Tom to help me continue to understand throwing technique, but he has taught me so much more, and I'm very grateful. Like I said, in order to achieve goals, it takes a great support system. I'm so blessed to have just that. Throwing was one thing, but early in my career, I knew I needed to improve my strength too. That's why when I was playing college football at the University of Michigan, I did extra weightlifting with the head strength coach there, Mike Gittleson. And when the New England Patriots drafted me, I found another strength coach in Mike Wojcik. From the beginning of my athletic career, I also worked extremely hard at improving my footwork and my conditioning. Whatever I was told to do, jump rope, practice my quarterback techniques, etc., I always did more. No matter what sport I was playing, I wanted to get better at it. I still do. John Wooden, the famous UCLA basketball coach, once defined success as the peace of mind which is a direct result of self-satisfaction and knowing you did your best to become the best of which you are capable. I believe any one of us can always do more and better, if we work to develop the right mindset. Competition is tough, and the further you go in athletics, the tougher both mentally and physically you need to become. Still, the fact is, it took me a while to find my stride in sports at both an amateur and an elite level. Once I did, I wanted to make sure I did everything possible to perform at a peak level for as long as possible. Playing the way I am today, after 17 seasons in the NFL, requires focus, discipline, and an openness to doing things differently. And that's been true ever since the Patriots won our first Super Bowl in February 2002. If you're going to achieve and sustain peak performance, you need that same focus, discipline, and openness. But let me back up first to talk about how things began to take shape in my athletic career. As an athlete, I was a late bloomer. I also wasn't someone who put a lot of effort into school, though I was a B-plus student who did well in math, statistics, and finance. The thing is, I never really applied myself to academics, since reading books would have taken time away from my much greater passion and time commitment for sports. As far as those sports went, I was a solid all-around athlete, but not an extraordinary one. Few, watching me play high school football or baseball or basketball, would ever have predicted I would someday end up playing in the pros. My first year at Sarah High School, I played freshman football, and we ended the season 0-8. The reality is that I never actually played, although I was the backup quarterback. I actually played more as a linebacker and tight end, which didn't turn out very well either. During my sophomore year, the freshman quarterback, Kevin Krestofiak, quit, so I tried out for JV football, which was basically a team made up of sophomores. We improved a little, but our record was still only 5-4. Not great, but I had so much fun, and I loved my coaches. In my junior year, I made the varsity football team. We finished 6-4, and in my senior year, our record was 5-5. When I joined the varsity team, by that point I wasn't playing basketball anymore. I was up doing 6 a.m. workouts most of the year, doing runs and rope drills and running over bags and up hills. But no matter how much work I put in, most of the time I still came in last place. The effort was always there, but better athletes were still running by me, jumping higher than I did, and testing better than I tested. Still, if I hadn't found my full identity and potential at football yet, I shined at baseball, which I played throughout high school as a catcher and left-handed hitter. In addition to playing football, I was on the varsity baseball team my junior and senior years, and the Montreal Expos picked me in the 18th round of the 1995 MLB draft. But by then, I didn't want to play baseball anymore. Ironically, the punishment it inflicted on my body and my knees especially was probably the biggest reason I ended up losing my love for the game. It was the pain I coped with day after day that led me to focus exclusively on football, though by that point my love of the game had overtaken my love of baseball anyway. In my senior year, my dad decided to put together some game reel highlights to see if we could garner any football interest from colleges. Even though we weren't a very good high school team, and I was extremely low on the scouting radar, I'd gone to a football combine at St. Mary's College, where for the first time ever, a few of the scouts watching just might have thought, hey, maybe this guy can eventually be decent. My dad had videotaped a lot of my games, and the school had some footage as well. And in the fall of my senior year, when football season ended, we brought the best of what we had to a local editor in San Mateo, who spliced together some reels. We ended up making 50 or so VHS tapes. Remember those? Of my playing highlights. I remember my dad and me flipping through a college book of Division I and two schools and asking, should we send a tape to this place? What about that place? We sent packages to the dozens of colleges I was interested in and that I thought I had a shot of getting into, and we got a few responses back. Army wrote something like, thanks for sending us your tape, but it doesn't look like your skill set fits our offense. Well, they did run the triple option at the time. Funny and true. I would have loved to attend the University of Southern California, which recruited me, but the University of Michigan was interested enough to send a recruiter, Bill Harris, out west, and in April of that year, Michigan offered me a scholarship, and USC didn't. Michigan was, and still is, in my opinion, the best Division I school in the country, combining athletics and academics, And the three coaches who recruited me, Bill Harris, an assistant coach, Gary Moeller, the head coach, and Kit Cartwright, the quarterback coach, were all on board when I chose Michigan in the spring of 1995. They knew me, and they also knew my parents. But by the time I arrived in Ann Arbor, Coach Moeller had been let go, and Bill Harris had left Michigan to become defensive coordinator at Stanford, which meant that two of the three guys responsible for recruiting me, and who knew me and my family pretty well, were gone. It's a dynamic that I'm sure happens in a lot of professions. The people who bring you in generally act as your mentors and champions and want you to do well. But when I first came to Michigan, there weren't a lot of people invested in my success. No one was actively rooting against me. They just didn't know me. And there were other players to think about. It was nobody's fault. It was just the way it was. Looking back, it was a great positive lesson at an early point in my career that made me more determined than ever, and I wouldn't change anything about it. Michigan recruited me as the fourth or fifth quarterback on the depth chart, which is a diagram showing where all the starting and backup players rank on the team in any given year. I was competing with another true freshman, Diallo Johnson, who showed up at Michigan the same time I did. The starting QB for the Wolverines was Scott Dreisbach, who was a year older than I was. The second quarterback was Brian Greasy, who was 2 years my senior, and who later went on to play very well in the NFL. And in third place was Jason Carr, the son of the new Michigan football coach Lloyd Carr. 4 games into the season, the Wolverines were 4-0, when during one of our practices, Scott Dreisbach dropped back to throw a pass, released the ball, and unluckily caught his thumb on another player's helmet. It turned out that he needed thumb surgery and was out for the rest of the year. Everyone moved up one slot. Brian Greasy started, Jason Carr was his backup, and I moved into the third position. Brian Greasy had a good season in 1995, but we didn't finish the year very well. We beat Ohio State 31-23, I remember, but lost our bowl game 22-20 to Texas A&M. Then, when the 1996 season got underway, we lost Kit Cartwright, who became the offensive coordinator at Indiana. Everyone assumed Dreisbach would come back and start as our QB. Michigan hadn't lost a game before Scott injured his thumb the season before, after all. And Jason Carr was gone, even though his dad Lloyd was still the head coach. But I still began competing to become the starting quarterback. It wasn't going to happen. Everyone loved Scott, and I started to realize that he would play through his senior year, which meant I'd be sitting on the bench for the next 3 seasons. During a meeting with Coach Carr, I told him I wasn't seeing many opportunities, and that where I was and where I wanted to be were two different places. Coach Carr told me I had the potential to be a very good player, and that I should just go out there and compete and worry about the things I could control, and not worry about the things I couldn't. He reminded me that I chose Michigan for a reason, which was true. Michigan was the best school for me. It was just disheartening not being able to play. What's more, the prospects of starting looked daunting, as I was mentally and physically behind Scott. As time went on and my frustrations grew, I was lucky to find, or be found by, our team's sports psychologist, Greg Harden. Greg had been at Michigan for many years and counseled many of the university's great athletes. One thing that impressed me was that Greg had also worked with Desmond Howard, one of the Wolverines' previous superstars. Howard, a return specialist and wide receiver, won the Heisman Trophy in 1991 and later played for the Redskins and the Packers. One time Desmond came into Greg's office and said, "Greg, I'm never getting the ball thrown to the right place. I'm always breaking my routes. The ball is all over the place, and I'm being forced to make all these diving catches." Greg's response was, "You know what, Desmond? That's why you're Desmond Howard. Desmond Howard can make all those diving one-handed catches no one else can make. If the quarterback was on the money all day long, every single play, no one would have a chance to see what you can really do." Those words have always stayed with me. And the lesson was, when things don't go your way, or rather, what you don't think of as your way, there can be a variety of opportunities that may not be obvious in the moment, but that through hard work, preparation, and persistence can present themselves over time and make you better. I'm never going to get my chance, I used to tell Greg. They're giving me only 3 reps, meaning practice snaps. Greg would say, 3 reps? 3 reps is a heck of a lot better than 0 reps. I want you to do the best you can with those 3 reps that they give you, Tommy. If you do anything less, then shame on you. Now go out and do those 3 reps well. His words further jump-started my own competitiveness. They empowered me, actually. Now, I had a plan. I would leave Greg's office and go to practice and do those 3 reps well. A week later, the coaches gave me 4 reps, then 5, then 6. As time went on, I was getting the majority of the reps. Every day during practice, I was competing as hard as I could, because I knew that if I didn't, there was no guarantee anyone would ever allow me to see any game time. I thought, if I don't treat practice like a game, there's no way the coaches will let me play in an actual game. So I'm always going to treat practice like a game. It's a rule I still live by today. My second year at Michigan, Scott Drysbach was our starting QB. And as the season went on, I competed with Brian Greasy for the second position. After a few weeks, Brian had slowly but surely beaten me out. Overall, we didn't have a great year. And late in the season against Penn State, the coach pulled Drysbach from the game and put Greasy in. Long story short, Greasy finished the rest of the season, and we ended up beating Ohio State 13-9, though unfortunately, we lost our bowl game again, 17-14 to Alabama. By now, the coaches were more neutral about Drysbach. Greasy was doing a solid job, but no one was really standing out, which is why when the 1997 season started, there was something of a free-for-all quarterback competition. It was never nasty, and there were never any bad feelings. All the QBs had good relationships with one another. Plus, I've never believed that entitlement has any place in team sports. If another guy is more capable of doing the job, it's his right to play. By that point, I was competing for playing time with Brian Greasy, Scott Drysbach, and a new guy, Jason Kapsner, a highly recruited player out of Minnesota. In the end, Coach Carr chose Brian, who was by then a fifth-year senior, as starting quarterback, and Brian deserved that spot. I became the second quarterback, beating out Scott, who ended up third or fourth on the depth chart alongside Jason. That year, 1997, we were undefeated, and it was a magical season, with Brian playing great and us winning every game and finishing off with a Rose Bowl victory over Washington State. Brian taught me a lot about drive and determination. Nothing was going to get in his way, and I was lucky to be able to watch him play. Looking back, I can see that he was a man on a mission, and he taught me what mental toughness really is. Going into my fourth year, I felt that I was in a position to be the starting quarterback, having beaten out Drysbach and Kapsner the previous season. With Brian Greasy gone, he had graduated, been drafted, and moved on to the Broncos. A new freshman, Drew Henson, came in. Drew was one of the highest-rated recruits in the country, a multi-sport athlete who'd been drafted that same year by the New York Yankees. In Drew, all the coaches thought they might have found the next John Elway. Coach Carr had been heavily involved in Drew's recruitment process, and a lot of people were really eager to see what he could do on the field. The thing is, over the previous 3 years, I'd grown as a person and as a player, gained more experience, and learned to compete really, really hard. I didn't mind the competition. Competition brought out the best in me. During training camp that year, I worked more intensely than I ever had in the weight room and on the practice field. I really tried to take it to another level, and it paid off when Coach Carr chose me for the starting job. Unfortunately, we lost our first game to Notre Dame 36-20. And a week later, we were blown out 38-28 by a great Syracuse team led by Donovan McNabb. 2 games in, both losses. It wasn't what you'd call an auspicious debut on my part. At this point, almost everyone wanted Drew to come in and replace me. But Coach Carr kept me in for the next game and, as it turned out, for the rest of the season. Because after those first two losses, we won 9 straight games to finish the year at 9-2. Then we went on to Ohio State, where, despite our team breaking a Michigan record by making 31 completions, we lost the game 31-16. Still, we won our bowl game 45-31 over Arkansas and finished the season 10-3. Overall, it was a pretty good year and a memorable one. In 1999, when I began my 5th season, the rivalry between Drew Henson and me had intensified. Everyone, the coaches, the fans, wanted to see Drew out there on the field. And why not? He was very talented, and he'd forgone playing baseball for the Yankees to play college football at Michigan. Still, our team was coming off a solid 10-3 season. 4 days before our opening game, Coach Carr called Drew and me into his office. He announced that I was the team captain and would be starting the game, with Drew playing the second quarter. On the basis of that, Coach Carr would decide at halftime which one of us was playing better and would play the second half. Early the following day, I remember telling my dad about Coach Carr's decision. Somehow, a member of the media got hold of my dad on the phone and asked for a comment. I think the reporter was trying to bait him, and he succeeded too. "How do you feel about your son starting against Notre Dame?" the reporter asked. "Well," my dad said, "I spoke to Tom, and he's really excited to play the first quarter, and then Drew will play the second quarter." Thanks to my dad, the media broke the story. After that incident, one of my sisters gave my dad the nickname Loose Lips. That nickname still fits him quite well. Drew and I played it out, as Coach Carr had said. During our first game against Notre Dame, I played the first quarter and Drew came in for the second quarter. Coach Carr decided I would play the second half, and we won that game, 26-22, scoring a touchdown in the last 2 minutes. The second game against Rice, I played the second half, and the third game against Syracuse, Coach Carr decided to have Drew play the second half. Midway through the season, against Michigan State, a team that also hadn't lost a single game so far that season, I played the first quarter and Drew played the second quarter, and Coach Carr again decided to have Drew play the second half. But only a few minutes into the second series, Drew threw an interception, and Coach Carr told me I was going back in. We finished the game strongly, scoring 4 touchdowns on our last 4 possessions. But Michigan State was on fire too, and we couldn't slow them down. We lost 34-31. It was our first loss of the season. I remember thinking, I played really well when I came back in, so maybe they won't rotate Drew and me anymore. Even so, a few days later, Coach Carr announced he was continuing the rotation. I didn't think too much about it, because at least I was playing. The following game against Illinois, we played at home as heavy favorites. As usual, I played first, followed by Drew, and then Coach Carr picked me to play the second half. Halfway through the third quarter, the big lead we'd built up was undone by a bunch of crazy things. Illinois scored 4 unanswered touchdowns. A high snap flew over my head, I threw an interception, and we ended up losing a game we should have won, which meant 2 straight losses. After the game, Coach Carr called me in to tell me he was giving up the rotation and that I would be playing the whole game next week. As if that weren't good enough news, we then won our next 4 games against Indiana, Northwestern, Penn State, and Ohio State, before beating Alabama in the Orange Bowl and finishing the season 10-2. Looking back, I can understand why all those other quarterbacks were playing before I was. I also understand why Coach Carr wanted Drew Henson and me to rotate. Still, it made for a tricky college experience, considering I was still learning a lot about who I was and how competitive college football could be. During my time at Michigan, I was fortunate to be in a competitive, team-first environment. I met lots of great friends and mentors. I'd shown up on campus in 1995 as an athlete who was soft of mind and heart. Learning how to fight for what I wanted was a great experience. But with my college years behind me, it was time to see if I could make it to the next level. In 2000, the New England Patriots and their then quarterback coach, Dick Rabein, chose me as the NFL's 199th draft pick, which, if you do the math, means that I was passed over by every team in the NFL somewhere between 4 and 6 times. The scouting report said I was tall, poised, smart, and alert, able to read coverages, I had good accuracy and touch, and I was potentially a team leader. But the positives were buried under a landslide of other stuff. Poor build, very skinny and narrow, can get pushed down more easily than you'd like, lacks mobility and ability to avoid the rush, lacks a really strong arm, can't drive the ball down the field and does not throw a really tight spiral. The report ended by calling me a system-type player who's not what you're looking for in terms of physical stature, strength, arm strength, and mobility. And could make it in the right system, but will not be for everyone. And these reports were right. I needed to get better in a lot of areas. In my first season with the Patriots, I was mostly the fourth quarterback on the depth chart. As usual, it was because I didn't have the natural ability some athletes had at that age. In order to compete, I had to work harder than ever before. Fighting to be able to play is something I've carried inside me my whole life, and it wasn't any different when I joined the Patriots. From my college experience, I picked up a lot of great lessons, the biggest one being the importance of competition and of the need to earn my role on a team. That lesson, that attitude, has always mattered a lot to me. When I arrived at Michigan, no one ever promised I'd be the starting quarterback by my second year. Compare that with today, when some student-athletes make it a condition of accepting a college scholarship offer that they'll see game time in their first or second year. My first year with the Patriots, our head coach Bill Belichick said flat out that he wanted only one thing, competition. My response was, hell, I know how to compete. I've been doing that for the last 9 years. Nobody ever gave me anything. You want competition? Okay, great. Let's compete. I approached it just like I had at Michigan. I worked my butt off every day in practice, knowing that if I didn't make the extra effort to treat every practice like a game, it was unlikely that the coaches would ever let me play in an actual one. I wanted to gain the respect of my teammates. Again, my mindset back then was to always treat practice like a game, and it's still my mindset today. During my first Patriots season, if I scored a touchdown during a 2-minute practice drill, I celebrated as if I were in front of 70,000 people. I have to believe this had a positive effect on my teammates, who thought, oh my God, this guy wants to practice. He wants to compete. There's no entitlement here. This is all about the team. Still, I had never achieved anything without the intensity and discipline I brought to practice, and a mindset increasingly focused on making sure my body stayed healthy and uninjured. The scouting reports weren't totally off base. I didn't have a natural body for football. Yes, I always had a pretty good arm, but my footwork was below average. And just like in high school and college, when I would run last or next to last before working my way back toward the middle of the pack, I was the slowest guy on the field. It took me at least a year to catch up and be able to compete with the older guys. At 23 and 24 years old, my only goal in life was to make the team, and I kept putting in the extra effort because I had to. With every level you reach, everyone gets faster, stronger, and better. And I had to work really hard just to be competitive. That's why every Friday at 6 a.m., when no one else was around, I work with our strength coach Mike Wojcik, doing speed and footwork drills, trying to close the gap between me and my teammates. It was around this same time that I started becoming more and more aware of what was changing in my body. There's a big difference between playing college football and playing football in the NFL. I didn't know it at the time, but at Michigan, I was doing half the workload the NFL demands, and at half the intensity too. When you play college football, the season is only 12 or 13 games long, and you practice and work out no more than 4 hours a day. Also, there are probably only 4 or 5 games during the college season that are truly intense, in which the two teams are of the same caliber and are evenly matched. The NFL is different. The job begins at 7 a.m. every day and goes until 6 p.m. Every game is a heavyweight brawl, and the intensity never lets up. An NFL season has 4 preseason and 16 regular season games, and the Patriots have made the playoffs almost every year since I've been the starting quarterback, which adds up to between 20 and 24 games per season. In short, when I began playing for the Patriots, it was double the practice and double the intensity. Until 2011, NFL teams had what they called two-a-days, twice daily practices with very intense throwing. After a couple years of two-a-days, plus the pounding my body was taking every day on the field, I got to a point where the tendonitis in my right elbow was so bad, I could barely throw the football. Physical pain was something I'd been dealing with since high school. Back then, almost every day after baseball practice, my elbow hurt so much that I would go home and drop it into a big bucket of ice. I didn't know anything different. If my shoulder was sore, which it was most of the time, I'd put a big bag of ice across my neck and upper shoulder. Playing catcher meant that I spent most of my time in a squat, which brought pain to my knees, which meant even more ice packs. The pain followed me to college, where my arm and shoulder ached after almost every practice and game. Not knowing any better, I assumed that was just the way it was. It was football's fault. I blamed the sport. So I did what I'd always done and what every trainer and coach had always told me to do. I iced my arm and shoulder, rested for a day or two, went back onto the field, threw again, and waited for the pain to come back. It always did. Basically, I followed the same systematic strengthening and conditioning approach that athletes at all levels and in all sports have followed for decades and still follow today. Strength training, in which you use free weights, machines, or your own body weight at higher and higher levels of volume or intensity, mixed with shorter and shorter periods of rest, is designed to increase muscular strength and endurance, which in turn allows your muscles to handle even more weight. Whereas conditioning focuses on aerobic exercise, plyometrics, calisthenics, and exercises based on real-life motions. Basically, any way to elevate your heart rate and make you break a sweat in order to prepare you for competition. You do cardio and lift weights, and do your best to find the right balance between them. If you get injured while training or playing, you assume it's because your muscles are weak. Your first instinct is to strengthen that perceived weakness by lifting weights. But lifting more weights isn't the solution. The core problem is an imbalance among strength, conditioning, and pliability. So adding heavier weights to that injury, an existing imbalance, only makes things worse. Heavier loads lead to even more imbalance and more muscle compensation, which lead to more injuries. Strengthen, condition, get injured, go to rehab. That was and still is the nature of the age-old performance training regimen. I never questioned that model or way of thinking, and no one else I knew did either. I also didn't consider any alternatives, because as far as I could tell, there weren't any. Not to mention, since I was young, coaches and trainers had always told me that playing sports was all about dealing with pain. It was just a fact. It seemed to me that playing sports, one of the great joys and opportunities of my life, strained and pounded and broke down my body. That's when I began exploring better ways to train. The reason for this book is to educate others to take a more preventative approach to injury. In the health and medical worlds, there's been plenty of talk about the benefits of wellness and preventative measures to keep people from getting sick in the first place. Why don't we do the same thing in sports training? Why hasn't the science of preventative health measures translated into the world of sports? This book and the TB12 method are my attempts at an answer. To me, the only way to break the age-old strengthen, condition, injury rehab model is to incorporate the most important missing leg, pliability. As I said, playing sports has been one of the many joys and privileges of my life. But I've also seen how the grind of training and the punishment that sports inflicts on our bodies takes away that joy for too many athletes. Along with the championships I've been fortunate to be a part of, I'm also proud of the mindset and approach I've taken to push myself to a different model of training that creates and enables my own sustained peak performance. This regimen is one I want all athletes of all ages to experience. And the principles that fuel the sustained peak performance I've enjoyed over the years are, I believe, also the future of sports training. The TB12 method that Alex and I develop allows me to feel, play, and perform every week at levels as high as or higher than they were back when I was first given the opportunity to step onto the field as the Patriots quarterback. This is borne out by my own experience. I've been faster every year for the last 6 years, and I've also broken my own personal best in agility and functional strength tests. Over the same period, according to conventional wisdom, this doesn't happen to athletes in their 30s. But back in 2000, before I knew what pliability was, my love for football, together with my innate determination and competitiveness, got me through whatever pain I was experiencing and pushed me to give the game my absolute best effort whenever I was given the chance. It was in my second year as a Patriot in 2001 that I finally got an opportunity to play and to prove to everybody what I'd been preparing for and what I'd always believed I could do. It was the second game of the season, the first after the September 11th terrorist attacks. A hot, humid night in New England. The Patriots were playing the New York Jets, and the Jets were up 10-3. I wasn't expecting to play that day. We had a great leader in Drew Bledsoe, our starting QB for the previous 9 seasons. But 5 minutes before the game ended, on 3rd and 10, Drew was chased out of the pocket by Jets defensive end Sean Ellis and collided on the sidelines with their linebacker Mo Lewis. It was one of the loudest hits I can ever remember hearing. When Drew left the field, Coach Belichick called me into the game. Everything was happening fast, and the only thing I could do was react to the moment. Despite the fact that I had played only minimal minutes the prior season, it just felt like football, like something I'd done many times before. Although I was sad to see Drew hurt, I didn't want to let down the team by playing poorly. During my rookie season, and even during the 2001 season, I never could have imagined the injury to Drew and how that would affect my opportunity to play. All I knew for sure was that if I got a chance, that was all I was going to need, even though the only reason I got that chance was that one of my teammates got hurt. It wasn't until a few days later that we all learned Drew had suffered a very serious injury and would be sidelined for most of the season. We lost that game against the Jets, but it turned out to be a Cinderella season for the Patriots organization. And for me as well. For the next 14 games, I was the quarterback, and we went 11-3. During the playoffs that year, our place kicker, Adam Vinatieri, made a few unbelievable field goals. 2 during a game we played in a blizzard against Oakland, and a 3rd game-winning one when, as underdogs, we beat the defending Super Bowl champions, the St. Louis Rams, aka the greatest show on turf, in Super Bowl 36. That part was good and even amazing, but as time went on, 3 or 4 years into my Patriots career, I got more conditioned than ever to the fact that no matter what I did, my arm and shoulder were going to be hurting. By 2004, at age 27, I was pretty much constantly aware of the wear and tear on my body. 27 may sound young, but by their late 20s, most athletes who played contact sports their whole lives come up against injuries and imbalances in their bodies among strength, conditioning, and pliability. We're all born naturally pliable, which is why we focus on strength building and conditioning in our teens and 20s. But as our natural pliability diminishes with age, we become more aware of the toll that maximum versus optimal strength training takes on our bodies. In my case, that meant more pain, more soreness, more stiffness, longer and longer recovery times. Why? I was plenty strong, but my pliability was running out, and running out to the point where the pain I was experiencing wouldn't allow me to play the sport I love to play. Sometime during the 2004 training season, one of my teammates, Willie McGinnis, saw me taking time off practice and took me aside. Like me, Willie was from California, and he'd played college ball at USC. He was a linebacker, one of the most talented players on the team, and a major contributor to our Super Bowl wins in 2001, 2003, and 2004. Willie had a certain aura and charisma about him. He was the godfather of the locker room, and he'd always been like an older brother to me. Seeing what was happening, Willie suggested I meet with his body coach, who at the time was Alex Guerrero. Without that meeting, the TB12 method would never have come to exist. When Willie recommended that you do something, you did it. Still, to be honest, I didn't expect much of anything. Alex may have come highly recommended, But what could any trainer or coach do that was different from what I'd been doing since high school, which is to say use ice and rest, then play and do everything I could to avoid injury and rehab, all while keeping up my strength and conditioning, while getting the same unsatisfactory results every time. I had nothing to lose, but still